It is absolute chaos and something that I still strive to control because I'm an absolute control freak, but I also am a stubborn bastard and I'm determined to make this work at all costs. So being a workaholic helps, and I use that term very seriously. I have friends that have their addictions, and I see my work habits as a full-on addiction because it is also something that is an avoidance of mental health, and I think other workaholics should know and acknowledge that as well. A lot of the times we pour ourselves into the work because there's something else in our life that we're avoiding, and I know that's something that it's kind of like the highest functioning addict you can be is being addicted to your work because it's hopefully the one thing that can make your life better. I'm Gary Lockwood, better known as Freehand Prophet, and for the last 10 years, I've been making one-of-a-kind masks out of highly coveted sneakers.
Whoa, nice intro, Gary. You've got that down to a T, mate.
And I try to work on that too. I'm like, every now and then I gotta switch the wording up so it's not the same every time. But yeah,
Tweak it a little bit.
exactly. I'm big on being concise and clear in communication, and so especially when you do something that is so weird. I'll be at the grocery store and someone will, "Oh, what do you do?" "Oh, I'm an artist." "Oh, what kind of art do you make?" "I make masks out of sneakers." "Masks?" Yeah, masks out of sneakers. And it's just one of those things where it forces you to explain yourself the best you can as simply as possible.
Yeah, it's either developing this concise elevator pitch or lying. A guest I had on recently, a miniature artist, he lies. He doesn't like the questioning that happens when you say you're an artist. If you say you're a doctor or a nurse, there's no further questions. But if you say you're an artist, it's what type of artist? What do you do? How do you do it?
I think I need to come up with one that I just have in my back pocket. Like, I'm a carpenter or something like that. Yeah. See, then the danger is I would rather answer the questions about what I really do than answer questions about something that I don't do.
That's true. Just in case they start probing you.
You gotta ask a question or you gotta have an answer that nobody wants to ask you questions about. I clean porta potties. They're not going to have any questions about
That's it. You might not be communicating for very long afterwards.
that. Exactly.
Well, Gary, welcome to the Proper Job Podcast. Let's just dive straight in with the first question. There's a couple of jobs that spring to my mind, such as politician, policeman, perhaps journalists, where death threats might be commonplace, but I wouldn't have expected them to happen in mask making.
It's been some years since any of them were really that serious that like people were actually wishing me harm. I still get, negative energy, but some folks just lose sight of things or maybe just lose sight of what they're saying. When you get emotional or you get angry, you say things that you don't mean, like, "Oh, I could kill him." But like when you write those things down and send it to somebody's personal email, it has a different tone and a different context. And you take it a little bit more seriously. But I do think that the world and really the in specific the sneaker world, the sneaker community has come more to grips with that sacrifice, whether it's being done by me or another artist that also works with sneakers. It's a little bit more acceptable. What I was doing was just so far out of the box to them that, I kind of had to lead them a little bit to see why I was doing the things that I was doing and that it wasn't coming from a place of negativity, but a place of love. Like, I chose to work with sneakers because they mattered to me and I was passionate about them.
Were you expecting that? Were you expecting that backlash? Because you were talking about being controversial, but making masks from trainers, did you feel that was controversial at the time?
I didn't think so because I was picking up sneakers that I bought from an outlet, Nike outlet. They were on sale. It was a $20 pair of SV Blazers, and as an artist, we spend more than that on materials all the time. Like you can easily spend more than $20 on a canvas. You can easily spend more than $200 on a canvas. So for me, I was like, do I want to buy a canvas or do I want to buy some sneakers? Well, I don't care about a canvas. I don't care about paint, but I've been painting my whole life. And so I thought about making art from things that mattered to me. So it didn't seem controversial. It seemed personal. It seemed reflective. It seemed, it seemed to me like I was harvesting materials that were somewhat similar to what mask makers have been using for centuries, leather and hair and all of these things. But I don't have access to a lot of leather supply. I mean, now obviously 10 years in, I have a better idea of where I can go for leather supply. But at the time, I was, I don't know where to go to buy leather that goes into making sneakers, or just, a raw piece of nice leather in an interesting color. For me, it was easier to go to the, Nike outlet or a sneaker store and buy the sneakers and harvest those materials from products that at the time didn't sell. They were on the sale racks. And it, of course, evolved over time.
Because I know what it's like when you're starting things off. Like, there's the huge amount of self-doubt. You're like, am I doing the right thing? How did you jump that hurdle?
I'm still dealing with it, honestly. I released a very important piece yesterday. It was a mask made out of Red Octobers, which is, for those that don't know, is a shoe that sold at retail for $250. But because of hype and exclusivity, they are reselling for upwards of $8,000 for a pair. I don't have a pair myself, and I would love a pair, let me tell you, but I can't bring myself to spend that type of money on sneakers, no matter how much I am in the world and have made a life of it. But I have received an enormous amount of backlash because, people got used to me cutting up, some retro Jordans that were somewhat hard to get, but they could buy them for resale at like 300, maybe $400. When you're destroying something that people can't get because it costs thousands and thousands of dollars, they get a little bit angry about that. They feel like it's a waste. And for me, I look at it like a jeweler working with precious metals. I'm just making something else out of it. Now, of course, a jeweler can melt that gold piece down and use that again. But it's always looking to add value through the process. But you were asking, like, how do you kind of get that perseverance and to like deal with that negativity towards something that, you already have your own self-doubt. When I first started, I was working for an independent music label for a friend who was putting together their rap album. I was doing design work, personal management, and that's also the same time that I started making the sneaker masks. And this was a close friend of mine, but he was going around telling folks that I was never going to go anywhere making these sneaker masks. And I kind of already knew better than that because I was already gaining traction, and more so than what we were trying to do for marketing his album. So, me bringing things like, hey, this is working for me. Maybe we should apply that and we can kind of get some cross promotion going. He considered it me trying to build my name off of him. Fast forward 10 years later, that album never got released, but I'm still making a living doing this work. But I tell you all that to say, like, whether it's somebody that or some stranger on the internet, there's always going to be that negativity. For me, there's always going to be that negativity inside of my coming from myself as well, like you talked about with the self-doubt. But I can't let that stop me. And I think a lot of it has to do with following what you kind of are drawn to anyway, in the sense of, I'm doing what is authentically me. So if you don't like that, like you just don't like me. And not everyone's gonna like you. So you just kind of, maybe that's where the acceptance lies. It's like, it's somewhere there. And there's all different types of mechanisms that you kind of put in place to deal with those things. And you just kind of learn it over the years. I mean, in high school and middle school, I was really into graffiti, and I had art teachers tell me that I should give that up. It would never go anywhere. And now, if you look at the world, of course, the most influential modern artists are street artists and graffiti artists. And so, for all the times that I listened to those people tell me that something that I was passionate about wasn't gonna go anywhere or wasn't gonna be good or whatever negativity they had to say, I just decided to follow my own compass and decide like, no, this is something that's important to me, and you have to follow that, because a lot of times, if you're going to make a living or a career out of something that you're passionate about, it's going to take a lot of determination, and there's not really a roadmap there for you. So you have to be able to tap into that. I'm doing this because there's something that I want to see out there in the world. And you kind of hope and learn to tune that to also reflect what others want to see out there, and find that path that I don't even want to say is a compromise, but is a win for everybody. For example, I know folks like to see a lot of my pop culture mask work. And there's so much of the obvious, like, oh, this is Mickey Mouse or this is Donald Duck. Not to go with, just Disney off the top of my head. But so what I like to do is I like to squeeze in personal projects that represent pop culture influences of my own. That way it is a, like I said, something for a larger group of people, but also something that is solely for me.
I was watching one of your YouTube videos. I don't think it, well, not one of yours, but you're being interviewed. And one of the things you said, which was really interesting, was that if people didn't care so much about the things I'm slicing up, then it wouldn't tell the story I'm looking to tell. And I want to know what is the story
Exactly.
that you're looking to tell from this?
There's a lot of chapters to this story. Part of it is identity. Part of it is, how we shape our identity with these consumer goods, and how that plays into life. But also, for me, it's a celebration and reflection of hip hop, which has been my biggest inspiration. So the thing I love about hip hop is that balance between what I call the conscious and the mainstream. I grew up listening to Jay-Z and Talib Kweli, and I had friends that listened to Jay-Z, and I had friends that listened to Talib Kweli, but rarely did anybody listen to both. It was like you were either flying flashy or you were politically minded and like they say, conscious rap. But for me, I think it was best when it was a balance of both. The fact that the world is a very unstable place. There are things that need our attention that are very important, whether it be environmental issues, political issues, civil unrest, just all the injustices that are out there. We could spend lifetimes doing work to improve these situations. But you're going to get burnt out. Your life can't be that 100% of the time. Sometimes you need to stop and celebrate the things that you enjoy, whether it's a pair of sneakers, whether it's good food, whether it's, events like going to a concert. whatever that is, you have to take the time to enjoy our time here, even if it's just to remind yourself what you're fighting to protect, because it's so easy to get lost in the troubles and the woes of what's going on. And so the masks were a reflection of that. The sneaker being the fly and the flashy, the celebration of color and style, along with the gas mask, which was my main focus when I first started making the sneaker masks. And the gas mask being what I think is the mask of our times, representing all of those things, the environmental destruction, the civil unrest, the world at war. Now, of course, representing biological threats, like COVID, it kind of ties in and is a reminder to all of us that, like, not everything's all right with the world. Through the mask, there's other stories that are told as well, whether it be celebrating milestones like the 100th mask, which was a elephant mask, and inside the tusks, I put a memory card of the 99 masks that I created before that 100th mask, along with a poem that I wrote celebrating the history of elephants throughout human history and the different roles that they've played. And then, there's others that pay tribute to inspirations or pay tribute or help the grieving process when, I have mask number 200. Was actually a Falcor mask that told the collector's story of losing his mom and some of the things that she did for him growing up, being that, when he was homesick from school, she always put on Never Ending Story. And so it's a Falcor mask, the Luck Dragon from Never Ending Story. It's built on a hockey mask because she would take him to hockey practice. It has a pair of her Doc Martens built into the mask as well. So there are a lot of ways and a lot of stories and things that the masks themselves can discuss based on everything, the story that's eventually told through the photography as well as, with the mask, because of course the mask making was at first something that I wanted to do to create a surreal photograph without relying on Photoshop. So they really play off each other as well, the masks being as important and as of course the focus, but the photography to me is, I would say, at least 50% of the work, because most of the time that's what the people are seeing out there. Most people don't get to see a mask in real life, but they get to see the photography, and that gives me a chance to tell more of the story through, like I said, who's modeling it, the wardrobe, the environment, all of those things play into it.
Yeah, it seems like you have a lot of fun when you do those photo shoots. It seems like you have an idea in your head as that mask is being created, and then you're like, almost as you're working on the mask, you're thinking on how that's going to be portrayed to the audience.
There are ones that there are masks that while I'm making them, I've already had the photo shoot in mind, like from the second those shoes are in front of me. And there are times where I make a mask and I have to sit with it, sometimes for quite a while because I haven't quite figured out how that mask is going to come to life. I have a hummingbird mask that I made years ago that, I absolutely love, but I haven't officially released it yet because I haven't photographed it to meet my expectations. And I had an idea for the shoot in my head, because one of as I was talking about the surreal photography, one of my favorite artists has been Sandy Skoglund, who in the 80s started these installations like Radioactive Cats, they'd be these large installations, say like an all gray room with these. What I believe was papier mache at the time, radioactive green cats filling and running through the space. And so I had it kind of in my head that this hummingbird mask would be surrounded by these resin hummingbird sculptures that I also created. And I made this this rig with a grid above the photo backdrop with places to hang the hummingbird, the resin hummingbirds from fishing line, and got it shot, but it didn't translate the way it did in my head. And so I've been rethinking just that shot for years and keep going back to it and no, that's not going to work, or I need to do it a little bit different. Or even just give up on it. Sometimes you have to say, okay, I'm not in a place to realize this vision. I need to allow the work to live and get out there on its own and just accept that I did what I could with it rather than, hold on to something for years and not let it see the light of day.
Yeah, you've spoken about sacrifice a few times, and also in another video, you said a quote which I really like: "Sacrifice what you want for what you need." Where, what have you
Absolutely.
done in terms of like yourself? What have you sacrificed to get where you are?
I feel like I've sacrificed a lot, and it's hard to really put into words. In some ways, it's my health, where the work takes front seat over self-care. There are, times that you think, oh, the bonds with my family or my friends aren't what they should be because I've spent so much time chasing and making this a reality. The stress and anxiety of doing something that you're not sure is stable. And, of course now, every few years I feel like we're shown that stability, even in the most normal of 9 to 5 jobs, is kind of an illusion. You could be let go by a large company at any time, regardless of your position or standing or abilities within or for that company. So doing it for yourself is just dealing with that on a daily basis. Am I doing enough? Am I doing a good enough job that this is going to continue to keep me and my family fed and taken care of? And you have to be able to pivot and adapt because, things change. Pre-COVID, I was doing a lot of work for big brands for either events or launches or marketing promo, but all that changed with the COVID lockdown. So I had to change my approach and focus not only on the large work that garners the attention, like the sneaker mask, but also make art, excuse me, and collectibles that everyday folks could include in their life, like lace locks, like actually this mask over here that I'm working on is a 3D printed elephant print mask that folks can buy for 100, $200, depending on the mask and the paint job, and makes it much more affordable compared to a $10, $15,000 mask that I've spent months and months working on and that type of thing. So it's ever adapting, and yeah, you really gotta be able to pivot and see your best opportunities because they're not always going to be the same.
So COVID, in a way, like it's fucked around with a lot of people. Obviously, those bigger jobs and those marketing firms, the bigger firms, they've kind of like dropped a little bit. Have you seen an increase in traffic because of the gas mask kind of like idea? Has that been like the media picked up on that at all?
I thought it was going to go that route. I was like, oh, I've been talking about how important masks are for 10 years. This is like it's not something that you want, but if you're looking for a silver lining in a really dark storm cloud, like, oh, like I'm the mask guy. This will bring attention and people will be like, oh, this makes sense now. But it hasn't really. I saw some I'd say through the pandemic, I've probably seen better online sales for those smaller items. I feel like, with people not going out to stores or to shop as they would have pre-COVID, that they're doing more impulse shopping online. And of course, times are tight, but you got to buy that small little thing to be like, oh, okay, I gave myself a little treat. And for sneakerheads, maybe you can't buy a new pair of sneakers, but you can buy a accessory or a fresh pair of laces or something to just, they call it retail therapy, and I hate to use that because it actually doesn't do us a lot of good, and that's some of what the work is about too, is that like the consumerism isn't actually helping any of our emotions or helping us deal with any of these things that we're dealing with. But we all have vices and we all have outlets, and I think some of us shop to treat ourselves when times are tight, and even in small ways that can just kind of brighten up your day.
I would have thought 100% that you would have had huge traffic hitting your spot, and like media would have picked it up. But like, yeah, because I it's like almost when I was looking through the mass you've done, I was like, man, this guy's seen into the future. He's like preempted this situation.
It's one of those situations where you hate to be right. You're like, oh, I was right. Oh, I really wish I wasn't right. Like the fact that I have turned my hat rack into a mask rack is it's a trip to me. And I think too, I think part of it is early, maybe not through the media, but I had a few people pop up and be like, oh, are your masks, will they protect me from COVID? And I'm like, you're missing the point like entirely. Could they? Yeah, probably. But what you want is something comfortable that you're going to wear every day. We're in this for the long haul. You want to focus on protection, not on wearing a sculpture on your head. But I of course have to look at that as an opportunity to, and it's so it I fight with this because there was such a flood of people rushing to make masks and like pandemic masks early on, and we're still seeing a lot of it, and it kind of makes me cringe because a lot of them aren't looking at whether or not those masks are actually good for people to wear. A lot of them are dye sublimated polyester, and polyester doesn't offer the same protection that a cotton mask would offer. Same with the ventilated masks, which actually don't prevent a carrier from spreading that because the exhaust actually is just a flat out open exhaust. So my wife and I have been working on masks that are two layers of cotton and one layer of silk because there are studies that show that silk has a static electric kind of force field around it that prevents more of the virus to pass through. And of course now they're saying that the masks are almost, we'll see. They're still doing studies on this, and I hope it turns out to be true, but they're saying the mask may have acted in some way as a vaccine in the sense that a vaccine offers you a small dose that your body can handle and build an immunity to. Masks do not prevent all of the virus from getting through, but it lowers the amount of the virus that gets into your system, and therefore your body can hopefully build an immunity to it. That's one of the theories. But all of that said, to say that, I've been developing masks and different mask patterns and testing them out, and we're 8 months into the pandemic and I haven't released or sold any of these masks except for, to friends and family, to like test out and make sure, it's up to snuff. It's up to, because not only do you want it to protect you, but you want to be able to wear it. You want to be able to talk. It's a whole nother realm of mask making that wasn't my focus with the sneaker masks, but something that I feel as a mask maker, this is something that I should be doing and considering during this time. But yeah, like I said, it's one of those things where like I wish I was wrong. I wish masks didn't prove to be so important, and I'm hesitant to make money off of the pandemic. It doesn't seem like where I want to put my focus, but at the same time, there's a way to do it right, and I just want to make sure that it's done right.
Yeah, I've seen those products you are releasing on your website and on Instagram. You know, it's always like shoved in your face, like as an artist, there should be multiple income streams. Because I'm thinking with your masks, like they're big pieces and they're not just going to go flying off the shelf every week or month.
Exactly. Right,
me. So I see that you've brought in these products, and yeah, I suppose even more now with COVID. I'm interested in like the research and development, the R&D you do with these kind of things, because you've just said there you send them out to friends to be tested. What's the process from like, I suppose, birth in your head to getting a physical product?
You know, it really depends from piece to piece. For example, the lace locks. Right now, my focus are the skull lace locks. It seems to be the most popular style that we've had. And, you know, I originally started making resin lace locks back in 2014, and they were miniature versions of my sneaker gas masks. So it'd be like a Jordan 6 gas mask that you could lace up onto a pair of Jordan 6s. But the style of sneakers kind of changed in, I would say, 2015, end of 2014. And the sneakers that were in style weren't really ones that would look good with lace locks on them. And I left them alone for years, stopped making them because I just felt that the demand wasn't there. Even though people would ask every now and then, oh, you're gonna bring lace locks back, and I'm like, you know, I used to work at a print shop, and I printed t-shirts, and everybody would always ask me when I would print a new t-shirt, but when I had a new t-shirt for sale, they wouldn't be buying. So I know better than to take a few inquiries as like an actual spike in market demand. But At the start of the pandemic, I was doing some resin work for a mask, and I decided to make a mold of the lace locks and bring them back. And they did fantastic. You know, this was, I want to say like March, may have been a little bit later. But anyway, it came at a time where all that brand work had dried up due to COVID, and we really wouldn't have been able to make it if it hadn't been for the fact that like people were ready to buy lace locks again. So since then, I've actually made a third version, basically refined that original skull lace lock that was hand sculpted in 2014. And then like in 2015, I shrank that original using an additive to a silicone mold that evaporates out, leaving the mold smaller than you originally cast it, which is pretty cool. So these miniature skulls then released 2020, and now I'm also doing 3D printing. So I redesigned that skull, did a model in ZBrush, so digitally modeled it and 3D printed it. And now I'm actually on to a fourth version where I'm not printing the actual lace lock to make a mold, but I'm printing the mold, which makes an even nicer end result piece. So you asked about, you know, from start to finish, and I always say there's really no finish, because you can always refine and improve on a product. It only depends on if there's enough demand that people like the original product enough and want more of it, that it pays to continue to make it better and better. And I hope that's something that I'm able to do with a lot of my products. But there is a little bit, I feel, with at least with my audience, I kind of call it the Supreme effect. So every week Supreme drops some random new collab, whether it's nunchucks or chopsticks or a pinball machine, and it sells out every week. And I feel like people want to see something new every week. So I could do a new color of a lace lock, and they're like, I've seen those. Where's that new style? And I'm like, oh, I'm one guy. I'm going to need a few months before I have another style ready for you. But what you end up doing is having multiple pots on the stove at all times, so that, you know, you end up like a farmer. You have multiple crops, so that if one crop doesn't turn out, you still got, you know, five or six other types. and fields to harvest. And if everything comes in at the same time, fantastic. You got a lot of work to do, but you kind of hit that stride of like, okay, well, this week is new lace locks. Next week is joggers, and I have a mask to release along with this t-shirt. And then we have this resin figure. We have this collaboration vinyl. You just kind of keep stacking it up, and eventually things kind of roll into a pattern or routine, or possibly they don't work out. They don't pan out. Some things just don't hit at the right time. I've released resin figures that nobody bought, and I ended up having to give most of them away to friends. And then years later, people are hitting me up. Where is this? I want this. Like, where were you years ago? That's another dance that you kind of have to do is you want to be ahead of the curve. You don't want to chase trends, but if you're too far ahead of the curve, folks aren't going to be there with you. You're going to have to wait for them to catch up to you. And that's not necessarily great for business. And it's also exhausting reminding folks, hey, this is cool now. I was doing this 3 years ago. This was doing this 10 years ago. Excuse me, my dog is deciding that he wants to. Hey, lay down, bud. Come on, Hank.
So you've got the idea in your head, and then you must be thinking, right, well, I've got all these, like you said, pots cooking on the stoves, and you're like, well, have I got space for this? How do you work that out? So before you've got the product where you can judge demand, how are you figuring it out in your head before you start, which obviously is a huge amount of work that, to research and develop it. How are you deciding that sort of like, do I go or do I just not do it?
Some of that is, like I said, you got to see the opportunities when they arise. For example, the joggers. I love wearing joggers, and I did not think I would be ready to, or that the demand would be there for me to be selling joggers, and that seems to be one of my biggest hits so far. And it's not something that I would have been able to do a couple years ago. It wasn't until one of the print shops that I work with gained that capability. And now I could have gone out and chased it down. And sometimes that's what you have to do is, like, if you really have a vision for a product and you don't have a supplier or a maker for that, sometimes you have to develop that or track down that resource. Other times you see a resource and you know kind of what you need to do with it. I would say, like, for the fashion thing too, it's kind of cyclical for me, because the sneaker mask came out of a project called Mask 365, where every day for a year I made or designed a mask and released it through my blog. But the reason I started Mask 365 was because I had in 2009 I started my own clothing line. Like I said, I was working at a print shop and printing t-shirts, and I realized, okay, if I need to market these t-shirts, I need to basically market myself. What am I? I'm an artist. People should buy t-shirts from me because I'm an artist and I'm making designer t-shirts actually from the designer. But I realized it had been a while since I'd made art. I had graduated in 2005 and kind of was turned off to the fine art world. I was focused on my graphic design work. But I said, okay, well, if I'm marketing myself as an artist, I need to make art every day. And so the Mask 365 thing came about. But it didn't necessarily help me sell t-shirts at the time. So I kind of gave up and stopped printing t-shirts because I just didn't have the, I mean, Los Angeles, we don't have a lot of space, when it comes to, our homes usually. And so, it comes at a high price, basically. So inventory for t-shirts was a difficult thing to store when they're not selling. Whereas, now I do a pin every month, and I'm also a pin collector. So I kind of just make those for me. They don't have to sell out. There's a good enough price point, and they take up so little room inventory wise that they can sit there. And if I sell one or two a week, great. That's just a little drop in the bucket, and something that I enjoy doing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Because that Mass 365, that was 10 year, I think 2010 you said. I was
Yep,
interested that
started in 2001. Yep.
you wrote that on your website, that exact thing you said, that daily creative project. And I'm interested in, like, why you say daily, and I wanted to understand the kind of philosophy behind that. It was it something that you wanted to make a habit of? So you hear the thing, do something for 21 days, it becomes a habit. Or was it something you
Yes.
just wanted to be absorbed in? You perhaps got addicted to it and you just wanted to get better. What was this kind of philosophy behind it?
The philosophy was definitely more of the first there. It was the idea that if you're going to talk about it, be about it. If I'm calling myself an artist, I should be making art every day. It was also inspired by Noah Scalin's Skull a Day project, which is and he talks about that too, is the focus is it's a creative sprint. And what happens is you basically exert all these bad, you don't really want to call them bad ideas, but the first idea that comes to mind isn't necessarily the best. And so through this exercise, you push out the simple, the raw, and you end up kind of you dig deeper and you get to something more unique. And it's something that, I also experienced in college at the Corcoran in DC. We had a project, I want to say it was my junior year, called 88 Works, and we had to make 88 different works of art based on this kind of like scavenger hunt like list in 2 weeks. So, that was even more than a piece a day. So I knew it could be done, and I knew that at the very least, it would, like you said, it would build that habit of I need to make art and I need to put it out in the world every day. And I'm so grateful that I did, and I've been so vocal about the benefits of projects like that, that my wife has done her own daily project. Close friend of mine, Sebastian, did a weekly project that basically grew into a whole new career for him. And I've just seen it do so much for so many different people, whether they consider themselves creatives or not. It's just, like you said, it's a muscle that you have to exercise, and the more that becomes a habit, the stronger you're going to get, and you really just don't know where it's going to take you. I never would have guessed that I would make a career or a name for myself making masks out of sneakers, especially not as a sculptor. The first 27 years of my life before Mass 365, I was a two-dimensional artist. If it was photography, graphic design, drawing, painting, whatever, if it was two-dimensional, I could do it. And I felt confident in doing great work in whatever that medium was. But when the assignment for class or whatever it was sculpture, I just didn't feel I had the aptitude for it. So, to be where I am now with it, and consider myself a sculptor, it's I say it all the time, but it's been a really crazy ride. Definitely not what I expected, and I think that's why I recommend it to so many people. I kind of laugh because it's like, for whatever reason, it makes me think of Pokemon and the evolutions of the different characters in Pokemon. And like, are you gonna stay where you're at, or are you gonna put in the work to evolve? And like, we all are capable of more than we even realize. And the only thing that kind of separates or stops us is ourselves, and whether or not we're taking those steps or we're following the path that we want to be following or should be following.
What part into that process did you go, oh wow, yeah, this is what I'm all about? What part into how far into that process was it, like where the light bulb went off?
So, Mass 365 started in May, and the first sneaker mask released, I want to say, like November 12th. We're about to celebrate the 10-year anniversary. And I kind of knew I was onto something, but I still had more of that year to finish. So I did a few more of those sneaker masks, like sprinkled in along with the other work that I was doing, whether it be, painted plaster masks or designs of animal gas masks, quite a variety within Mass 365. But once that project was done, and I didn't need much time to reflect and go, this is where I'm heading. I'm going to do more of the sneaker mask work. And I played around with some different things. I even did a series that was spray paint cans wrapped in sneakers. And I took a Airsoft AK-47, painted certain parts gold, wrapped certain parts in Dickies and Chuck Taylors and bandanas tied like Pac used to do with the bunny ears in front, and did kind of a West Coast hip hop tribute piece. Kind of, same kind of techniques and sculpture and concept, but just didn't have the legs that the mask work did. There's really something powerful about taking these pieces of artwork and breathing life into them in a very real way by putting them on a person, and then, bringing the character out of that mask even more through the photo shoot, through the modeling of it.
How did it then come about where you could actually see it becoming a way of making money?
There was a few things. So I want to say it was the ninth mask was a Stormtrooper helmet made out of Adidas that were actually a Star Wars collab. So it was like embossed white leather with little Stormtrooper helmets on it. And I made a Stormtrooper helmet out of those sneakers. I posted that for sale on eBay, and it sold, and it was one of my, I'd never sold a piece for $2,000 before. And I was like, okay, let's see if I can sell another for that. And there was obviously, some work to get to that price point, but it wasn't long before people were reaching out to commission me to make masks out of whatever sneakers they chose. And actually, one of the first commissions, and actually I have it tattooed on my arm here, was the LeBron 4 Dunkman. And that actually came from the designer of the sneaker. So to me, that was like, okay, this is it. Like, if the sneaker designer is into this, and going back to like, how do you quiet those negativity, the haters, the doubters? Well, trust the experts. And if there's qualified folks that are saying, hey, this is cool, this is, keep doing what you're doing, listen to those opinions above all else, because that, is important.
So that was your eighth mask. How long was that from starting?
I want to say it was later that summer. So it started in May 2010. May 2011 is when Mass 365 ended, and I was like August or September that that Stormtrooper mask released. And there was a few masks that I made in between that and when the commission started, that were, made and sold to various collectors or at art shows, art fairs. But eventually it became more of an online presence rather than something that people would see in person and buy.
'Cause you've spoken about that kind of process, and you said about the elephant tusks, how it had the memory card in and a poem. How much do you put yourself, so getting a commission, for instance, Does the client go, you go with it? Or is there a little bit of, I want a little bit of this in there and a little bit of that? How do you sort of like make that process? Because most artists are like, I want to make what I want to make.
Sure. It really depends on the project and the client. I have some clients who will say, I just want a mask. Tell me what you want to work with. Tell me what you want to do. Just give me an idea and we'll go with that. Other folks will say, I want it made out of these sneakers. What do you think we should make out of these sneakers? Other folks will say, I have an idea. I want a mask inspired by Iron Man. What sneakers do you think we should use to make an Iron Man mask? Other times, and usually with the big brands, there's a little bit more of a strict concept that we come up with. But, you know, even with that, they usually give me pretty good creative freedom. They just want to know ahead of time what I'm going to do, which is interesting because a lot of the work I consider a freestyle. I don't do a lot of planning going in, but again, depending on the client, sometimes they want to see that. And so I'll do a sketch or a mock-up going into it. So it really depends on the client, depends on the project, and depends on the budget. You know, if they're paying right, then they can have as much control as they want. But, you know, if someone wants to save a little bit of money, release more of that creative control, and that's something that, you know, I work with and negotiate with my collectors on, based on, you know, their needs and the work that it's going to require me to do, you know. And also, like, deadlines play a big part of that. You know, do they need it? Like a fine art collector, they don't need it next month. You know, most of them take the attitude that the more time I spend on it, the better value they're getting, because, you know, they're getting way more hours than if they were paying, you know, if they were paying hourly for this piece, it would cost way more. The brands, however, have hard deadlines and they need it in a few weeks. So that puts up different, you know, restrictions and possibilities and changes the budget, of course, you know, because squeezing 200-300 hours worth of work into 2 weeks is different than spreading that across months or years even.
So from your perspective, like for the people who are listening to this, obviously it's going to be really difficult for you to say this, because from what you've told me so far, there's like photography, there's CAD skills, 3D printing, you've got fashion, draw, you've got so much going on. But in a week, for someone who's saying, oh, that sounds pretty interesting to get into, can you tell me what a typical average week would look like?
Chaos. typical and average are so, they sound like a daydream to me. Early on in the lockdown for COVID, I developed a daily routine and it was so nice. And it lasted about 3 weeks. And then the chaos got back. And it's juggling shipping orders, updating websites, handling social media, fielding phone calls, doing interviews, talking with folks, going into the studio, casting resin, making lace locks, sanding lace locks, polishing lace locks, cleaning lace locks, packaging, some more shipping, developing new products, modeling, designing the new pins and stickers and t-shirts, and then making time for more mask work. And, you know, I'm sure that was even an oversimplification, and I just grazed over certain things that take up huge chunks of my week and day. Why a lot of us chase these dreams and these passions to make a better, happier life. And it's good to keep that in perspective, because sometimes it can consume you and you end up making a life for yourself that you didn't intend to, trying to chase that dream. So there's a balance to be struck between living the life that you want to lead and moving towards what could be. Like, I guess that's the balance between what is and what could be. Not just settling for what is, but also accepting it, embracing it, while still moving forward for what's possible.
Gary, talking about being a workaholic, I'm going to let you get back to it, man. Thank you very much for your time today.
Sid, it was great talking to you today, man.
Have a great day, mate.
You too. You too. Great talking to you, Sid.
Thank you to all the people that listened all the way through to the end. As you can probably hear, the audio is pretty shocking. I get the guests to record it on their mobile phone using a voice memo app. I do the same. I then send it over to my iPad and do all the editing in there in a piece of software called LumaFusion. If anyone's out there who can help me in any kind of way with quality or audio, or if you've just got any feedback about the show, I'd love to hear from you. Send an email to sid@mail.uk. Cheers.